enough for Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Pepe Escobar will join us in a moment, the globe-trotting journalist who brings us offshore perspectives about the flotilla of refugees on the Mediterranean, the war zones in Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Iraq. We'll talk about the conflicts between Saudi Arabia, the U.S., Iran. We'll touch on the whatever war in Afghanistan and talk about the new Silk Road that Pepe writes about, China's expanding influence around the globe. That's all ahead in this freewheeling conversation with Pepe Escobar. And today's podcast is brought to you by one individual. I want to single out Gunnar Gunderson. He's a longtime subscriber who dropped me an email this morning to say that he's taken out not just one, but two new monthly subscriptions to support my work. And he mentions that if there's somebody who can't afford a subscription, he's happy to provide a scholarship. So if you'd like that, email Peter at peterbcollins.com, and I'll do my best to accommodate you. And if you're not a subscriber, please join us. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, and under my picture on the homepage, you'll find a link that says sign up. The next page, you can choose $5, $10, or $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers get the ebook edition of our guest Pepe Escobar's latest effort. It's called Empire of Chaos, and I'd be delighted to send you a copy with your new annual subscription. Pepe Escobar returns today. Yes, Pepe Escobar, the globe-trotting journalist. For him, it is a small, small world. And in up to an hour today, we're going to try to get his views on latest developments and flashpoints all around our planet. Pepe Escobar is the independent journalist originally from Brazil, and he now operates from a base in Paris. And you can read his work at RT, at Sputnik, Tom Dispatch, and Counterpunch. He is also the author of a powerful new book, a collection of his work called Empire of Chaos, and it continues as the bonus gift for new annual subscribers here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And Pepe, we've moved dozens of copies of your book, trying to get you up there to number one on Amazon. As always, it's great to talk with you.
Wonderful, Peter. Thanks very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And thanks everybody who bought the book or, you know, the Kindle edition, which is not exactly expensive. So thanks very much, everybody.
Well, and Pepe, there's so much to talk about today. As I mentioned, you had been based in Asia for many years, and you've now parked yourself in Paris. There's certainly a lot going on in that region and into the Middle East. And I want to start with the Mediterranean refugee crisis, because here in the United States, we get sporadic coverage. And when over 900 people died when that one ship capsized, it certainly got momentary attention on these shores. But I think it's a significant humanitarian crisis, and I think that it is the visible outcome of so many conflicts that are underway in the Middle East and on the African continent right now.
You're absolutely right, Peter. And the problem is Brussels, and I mean all the Brussels institutions, the European Union, the European Commission, in fact, the European Parliament in Strasbourg, and national governments all across Europe, they refuse to admit the number one obvious fact. This is all blowback because of NATO's liberation of Libya, mm-hmm. and then the war in Mali, and the constant destabilization of Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, you name it. And obviously the plight of sub-Saharan Africans inside Libya itself, which is now controlled by warring militias. It's an absolute failed state with weaponized militias roaming all around, from Tripoli to Cyrenaica in eastern Libya. And no wonder, where's the key departure point for these black Africans trying to reach Europe? It's the eastern coast of Libya. Mm-hmm. And where do they go, essentially? Sicily, in Italy, because it's the shorter boat trip, something like 80, 90 kilometers, 100 kilometers max. There is a horrible meeting of these nasty minds, let's put it this way, human traffickers, smugglers, corrupt policemen in Libya, and obviously some people in Europe as well, who, if they get hold of these migrants, then they distribute them across southern Europe especially. Obviously, there's no immigration policy in Brussels. They have been discussing this for years. It's just like their energy policy, which means we hate the Russians, we want to buy oil and gas from Iran, but we can't because the American won't let us. In the immigration, the non-immigration policy is the same thing. We don't care about these black Africans. They come here to steal our jobs, they pollute our streets, but we don't know what to do with them. Mm-hmm. So they had a program, an official European program called Mare Nostrum, which of course is the Latin Roman denomination of the Mediterranean, which included trying to manage the flow of immigration, especially legal immigration from Northern Africa to Southern Europe. They abandoned, they stopped financing this program. And now it's the Fortress Europe mentality, which is basically repression. And now, not even repression, because if they cannot police the waters of the Mediterranean, we have these boats capsizing all the time. And, you know, they had a meeting last week in Brussels to discuss that. Obviously, nothing. They came to absolutely no agreement on anything.
Well, they did throw a little more money at the problem. And, you know, what they described was this minimal effort to patrol the coastlines of Italy and Malta. But the boats that have been, you know, overloaded and foundering in the Mediterranean have not all been along those coastlines. And so they're going to, you know, ignore the vast swath of the Mediterranean where the real problems are and pretend that they're doing something about it.
Absolutely. That's it. In a nutshell, that's it. And in fact, they would like to ignore it. Unfortunately, when you have like a 900 people, almost 1,000 people dying in one particular incident, and there are going to be plenty more, especially, you know, going all the way to Italy. And the only country that so far has accepted at least to receive and try to settle most of these migrants is Italy. In a much smaller scale, we can say France, Germany, Sweden, and the UK. The rest of the European Union, they don't care. They don't feel concerned, and they won't do anything in terms of organizing a common EU immigration policy in Brussels.
And Pepe, not only that, what I'm picking up is that certain European leaders are that their solution to the problem is to try to seal off the ports in Libya without, of course, dealing with the underlying failed state in Libya and the migration that is all drawn there because of people who are so desperate to get away from hot wars and conflict zones.
You're absolutely right. You know what? When Gaddafi was still in power, we had one of the common traits of crossing the desert were those trucks full of sub-Saharan Africans crossing from the Niger Desert, for instance, on the way to Libya, but not to escape from Africa, to get a job in Libya. because jobs were available if you were relatively skilled, and then you could get a job, you could settle down, you had a residence permit, you were entitled to health care in Libya. It was a working state, and sub-Saharan Africans were welcome. In the new liberated by NATO Libya, run by weaponized Islamic or extra-Islamic or, in fact, practically jihadi militias, these people are not welcome. On the contrary, they are persecuted. So the only way for them to get to Libya is to get to the Libyan coastline and then get on a boat and leave. Because there are no other places to leave from. Malta, come on, it's ridiculous compared to the rate of illegal migration from Libya.
So, Pepe, you know, it's really painful to see the human cost and these desperate people who pay off these traffickers and just hope that they will arrive safely on the other side of the Mediterranean. But the bigger picture here is that these are the true victims of the American-led destabilization of key areas in this region. And you've already mentioned Libya, and I'll just note that we're continuing to chew on the Benghazi attacks of September 11th, 2012, but very few Americans hit Hillary Clinton for her hawkish policies that led to our involvement and our pushing NATO to not just set up a no-fly zone to protect some people in Benghazi, but to ultimately overthrow Gaddafi. And then when we look at Yemen, where the U.S. has used it as a military playground since Obama became president, drone strikes at will, commando raids whenever we want. When Saleh, the 17-year strongman, ran out of gas and, of course, was injured in that attack on his mosque, we eased him out and plugged in Hadi. And now we look back and say, what happened? How did these Houthis get so powerful? How did they gain so much ground? And how did Saleh, you know, come out of, you know, a mausoleum or wherever he's been to be the wild card in Yemen, who is riding his former enemies, the Houthis, in an attempt to get back into power?
Exactly. And, you know, I would say the key element of this whole charade in Yemen is only a fool would believe that the Houthis will go for a power play in Yemen when you have a CIA drone infested base right across the sea in Djibouti. This means that the Americans knew exactly what was going on and they let it happen. Because this, once again, this is divide and rule. This is, you know, more Sunni against Shiite strife and havoc across the Middle East. It's part of the proxy war against Iran, etc. And other element, very important. My friend Joe Loria, he's the Wall Street Journal correspondent at the UN. He broke a wonderful story this week. Mm-hmm. He talked to a UN envoy who told him that the real reason why the Saudis invaded and launched this this illegal air war against Yemen is that the different Yemen factions were about to reach an agreement for a power sharing agreement in Yemen, and Yemen would be in fact very progressive, and even women would be part of the government.
Yeah.
So can you believe how this falls in the ears of the House of Saud? Obviously, they freaked out completely having a progressive Muslim country across their border.
Yeah, women might be allowed to drive automobiles.
Exactly. Can you imagine that across the border? So, you know, I would say this explains 80% of the Saudi motivations. Obviously, they wanted a pretext to try to subdue Yemen or divide Yemen in two mm-hmm. again. They wanted a pretext to sell to Muslim public opinion and to the Americans, especially this is a proxy war against Iran because Iran controls the Houthis and they're weaponizing the Houthis and they want to destabilize Yemen, which is all, as we all know, bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, they are terrified that they cannot control anything anymore in their own GCC area. They don't control Qatar. Oman is too independent. Yemen, they have their own ideas. You know, they are only allied, in fact, with the Emirates and Kuwait. Mm-hmm. It's not much when you pretend to be the leader of the GCC, right? And now they have the succession. The guy who is who was until what these past few hours, he still is probably, because they said that the offensive is over, but it's not. The former Minister of Defense is the crown prince.
Right.
He's the son of Salman.
There's a reshuffle
of the House of Saud that happened this week, exactly.
Right. Uh-huh.
And it's fantastic because nobody even knows his age. It's fantastic. I was even scouring Saudi media to get his exact age. Nobody knows. Sometimes it's 32, 33, 34, 35. So it's this very secretive guy. Apparently, according to some of my Saudi friends from the Sudairi clan, by the way, they say that he's absolutely horrible to deal with. He's like a playboy driving a Lamborghini in London, that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he was until a few days ago, the Minister of Defense. And now he's going to be the second in the line of succession. So this is part of the power play of the Salman branch of the family against the sons of King Abdullah. So they are completely paranoid, surrounded. They think they're being persecuted by everybody. They don't trust the Americans anymore. They rely on the Israeli lobby to sell their ideas in Washington. So, you know, okay, when you are in such a situation, what do? You go for a war.
Mm-hmm.
Which, now, by the way, they already lost because nothing changed in Yemen. And this war won't change anything because the Houthis now are even more radicalized. And because everybody in Yemen, as we all know, everybody is weaponized as much as in Afghanistan. Like, everybody has a Kalashnikov or a few RPGs in their backyards. This thing could go on for a long time and destabilize the House of Saud itself in the long run.
Pepe, I had a chance to talk to Joe Lauria a couple of days ago.
Excellent.
About the story that you referenced in the Wall Street Journal. And it is fascinating because the peace talks that had been brokered by Jamal Benamar, the UN envoy, were
yes.
very close to a deal, as you referenced, that included women. It also included they were arguing over the finer details of how Hadi would be allowed into this interim ruling council, but not as the president. And so it's fascinating that, we were on the verge of peace when the Saudis decided it was time for them to launch unilateral airstrikes. The other things that that Lauria pointed out, number one, that Egypt is very wary of putting its own ground troops into Yemen because it had its own Vietnam-style quagmire there in the 1970s, and
right.
thousands of Egyptians were killed. So even though al-Sisi is a strong man, he's the new Mubarak and can pretty much do whatever he wants, he's pretty sensitive to that legacy. And in addition, Lauria pointed out that the Saudis are pissed at the U.S. over the talks with Iran and also exactly. over their perception that Obama bluffed and then backed down on his so-called red line about Syria's use, alleged use, of chemical weapons. So those are the factors that Lauria cites as driving the Saudis. But I'd like to ask you if you can explain the pause that Saudi Arabia announced in its airstrikes, and then 20 or 25 minutes later, they resumed and have not stopped since. And they claimed at that point that they had achieved their mission without defining what such a mission was. And so it's still very murky why the Saudis started at the end of March to pound Yemen. And it's fairly apparent that the United States was uncomfortable with that and ratcheted up pressure over time to get the Saudis to stop.
Yes, but exactly. And then they stop for a few hours and go back to it because, you know, everybody knows that they didn't win a war. Everybody knows that this war is long running. Everybody knows that if they want to subdue Yemen, they need troops, which no one is willing to provide. And on top of the Egyptian angle, I would add the Pakistani angle because they were practically imploring for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to send Pakistani trainers, especially, which are very, very good. And you find Pakistani trainers all over the GCC. Pakistan said no. Instead of sending troops to Saudi Arabia, they prefer to do deals with the Chinese, which is what happened a few days ago as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Saudis are completely isolated, they are still trying to observe these changes inside the House of Saudi, and what does it mean for the future of the country? It means that they're going to be much more aggressive, but without even thinking about consequences and blowback, which was, okay, obviously nothing changes in terms of being an absolutely disgusting dictatorship. But under King Abdullah, at least they were predictable. Now, with this crown prince as minister of defense and in charge of the operations against Yemen, nobody knows what they could do. They became a wild card. And a lot of people across the Middle East, not only the Egyptians, but the Jordanians, for instance, everybody's wondering what they're going to do next.
Mm-hmm. Now, Pepe, because of your unique perspective, and I love getting your offshore views, I just want to ask your take on this particular episode. Obama was on a state visit to India when King Abdullah died, and he not only changed his travel plans to make a quick trip to Saudi Arabia to hold hands with the new King Salman, but he also rallied the entire deep state. When you look at the list of American dignitaries who suddenly showed up in Saudi Arabia when Obama made that last-minute decision to parachute in to greet the new king, I thought the imagery, the optics of that spoke volumes.
Absolutely. And, what is trying to be sold in the U.S. as the Obama administration pivoting towards Iran, this is absolutely ridiculous. I was writing about this for Asia Times today before our talk. This is coming this weekend. It's a story about how the whole war on terror is in fact a hoax and in fact a fraud. One of the objectives of the war on terror is to be to have a constant proxy war against Iran. This is, there was a Rand Corporation report in 2008, which its title is actually Unfolding the Future of the Long War. The Long War was coined by the Pentagon, a think tank inside the Pentagon. The Rand Corporation was part of it. And then they kept issuing reports on how to develop the Long War, which is our good old war on terror, which is also a war by proxy against Iran. And the spearhead of this proxy war is Saudi Arabia. So, the entente between Any administration in the U.S., be it Bush or Obama or the future Hillary-Rater administration, and the House of Saud, if it's King Abdullah, if it's the Sudairi clan, doesn't matter. That's it. We control the Middle East. You are our preferred bastards, and we do anything together to prevent Iranian aggression or the ascension of Iran or whatever. And we keep having more and more elements to support this, this fact. It's not a projection. It's not think tank wishful thinking. It's a fact. And no wonder the whole deep state went to Riyadh. It was more than predictable, in fact.
Yeah, it was quite a photo op. So let's turn next to the proxy war in Syria and neighboring Iraq, where the complications are so mind-boggling that in some ways they almost defy description. But in Syria, Iran is aligned with the Assad government and with certain elements of the rebels that are arrayed against him, as we try to both take out Assad and vanquish the Islamic State from Syria. We have conflicting alliances and lines of authority. Then we just go over the border into Iraq, where we're running airstrikes that are called in indirectly by members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who are advisors to the Shiite militias. And all of this, lacks a specific mission. There is no end game that has been articulated by anyone. And it does fit the definition of this kind of long, endless, open-ended war that just slogs on, and we're just supposed to sit back and say, well, this is the new normal.
You're absolutely right, Peter. In fact, there is no mission, there is no end game, there is no overarching Middle East policy in terms of the Obama administration, not at all. Everything is ad hoc. They have no clue what they're doing. And no wonder we had this "don't do stupid stuff" issued by the commander-in-chief himself, because they are doing stupid stuff all the time, and they don't even know which way and who they are supporting. You know what they are supporting in practice now in Syria? Al-Nusra Front, which is the Syrian Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. The Americans are giving intel to these people, directly and indirectly. They just took over Idlib a few days ago.
Right.
Idlib is a very important town, and they could not do it by themselves, only with, you know, satellite intel, you name it. And the Americans provided it via some of the rebels they are financing. The problem is these, you know, moderate rebels, they are in close contact with the al-Nusra Front, and some of them are al-Nusra Front disguised as moderate rebels.
Right.
So obviously the CIA, because they don't have intel on the ground, they have no clue about this. On the other side of the border is even more complicated, because the only ones who can actually have a fighting chance and a winning chance against ISIS, ISIL, Daesh are the Shiite militias in Iraq, which are supported by Iran, some of them weaponized directly by Iran, like the Badr Brigades, for instance, which is a kind of offshoot of the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. Without these people, you won't win against Daesh on the ground, period. That's the bottom line. You can bomb anything. In fact, they were bombing the outskirts of Mosul, the Americans, until a few days ago. This will lead to nowhere. If you don't have boots on the ground and if you don't engage in battles, you won't, you know, win against ISIS, ISIL, Daesh. So, you know, so it keeps going with no end game in sight. It's dividing rule, but with different rules in each side of the border. On Syria, on mm-hmm. Iraq, mm-hmm. in Lebanon, in the GCC itself, in Yemen, it is completely crazy. If you try I've been trying for a while to say, okay, what is the overarching pattern of all these escalations, de-escalations, weaponizing, financing from an American point of view? And it's impossible to find it because there isn't any.
And Pepe, this is further complicated, of course, by the nuclear negotiations with Iran, the P5 plus one. I mentioned that to once again underscore that this is not a bilateral accord between the U.S. and Iran, which is what many conservative Americans who want to scuttle these talks have tried to frame it as. But, you know, this is the only positive development under Obama's foreign policy, and in particular for Secretary of State John Kerry. And getting from here to July 1st and even keeping the framework intact seems, Herculean at this point. And with the saboteurs who are lined up, some who are, you know, reflecting the interests of Israel, some who are taking pot shots at Obama for domestic and partisan political reasons. But it's so mind-boggling for me that we have people who are actively trying to scuttle these talks, which I consider to be peace talks, and yet they won't honor the authority that the Constitution invests in them to develop war powers for the current adventures that Obama has started without any congressional authorization. So here we have people who are abdicating their clear responsibilities on the war powers issue, but meddling and really attempting to interfere in the executive branch's efforts to develop this new framework. And to, you know, as you and I know, based on the work of Gareth Porter and others, this is all based on this myth that Iran has been actively trying to develop a nuclear weapon.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you go ahead. You know the framework here.
Absolutely ridiculous. And look, I was with Gareth in Iran. We traveled to Iran together 6 months ago. And we talked to a lot of very important people, in fact. They have no illusions about the whole negotiation process. They say they won't back down. Their guidelines are very, very clear. They want they are willing to be circumscribed in developing their nuclear program with IAEA inspections, you name it, as long as all these sanctions disappear. If it doesn't happen, there won't be an agreement, period. And this comes from the supreme leader himself. It's right from the top, goes through Rouhani, goes through the Zarif people from the Ministry of Foreign Relations who are involved in negotiations. Everybody in the negotiations, they know it, especially the Russians and the Chinese, which are the first to say the Iranians are right. We need a deal, but the sanctions have to go. Mm-hmm. So then we have the U.S. and obviously the Germans, the French and the Brits, the Western camp, which comes with, okay, so now we're going to talk about the ballistic missiles that Iran still does not have to deliver the weapon, the nuclear weapons that they still don't have. Mm-hmm. And now we can, we need an extra clause saying that they have to recognize the right of Israel to exist.
Right.
You know, none of this has anything to do with the technical discussions about how to organize or reorganize the Iranian program. Mm-hmm. And they already, in fact, if you follow, and Gareth has been following this in detail, they accepted practically everything that was thrown at them, except dismantling their peaceful nuclear program. So this is where we are, a number of centrifuges, etc. This in the next 2 months, we can have agreements on all the technical issues. But all the extra diversions, that's the problem. And the Americans keep throwing everything. When we think that we have a makeshift deal, they come up with another demand. This is what some of the Iranian negotiators and past negotiators told us in Tehran. And it's true. If you follow the record, it's true. And at least, you know, Gareth is one of the few who's following it in detail. And also, if you read Iranian media, independent Iranian media, especially some of their think tanks, they follow in detail with numbers, etc. Mm-hmm. The problem is those who don't want the deal, which we know those who don't want it in Iran. They are the extreme hardliners. But in Iran, they are already a minority. They have been marginalized by the supreme leader himself. The supreme leader said, look, let's go for a deal. If we don't have a deal, then you can let loose and do whatever you want. I'm talking about some hardcore Revolutionary Guards factions. Mm-hmm. What about those in the West? Then we have a coterie of people, like we say here in French. In fact, we have a whole restaurant of we have a brasserie full of people eating their steaks. And no, we have to bomb this deal. So we have the Israeli lobby, the Saudi lobby, parts of the industrial military complex, corporate media, a lot of think tanks, you know, the editorial pages of the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, you name it. It's a lot of people. And of course, most of Congress, I would say 80% of Congress, is against this deal. So it's very complicated. And we have only 2 months. It's not going to be a technical, because this is essentially a political discussion between Iran and the U.S. And it's being sold to the rest of the world as a multilateral negotiation between six countries on one side and Iran on technical issues. It's not. This is a it involves an extremely hardcore political decision by the Obama administration. Are we going to have one single foreign policy victory in 8 years? Yes, and that's it. If we don't have this deal, nothing's going to, we're going to be, you know, treated by history as a bunch of minions. But what's the price we have to pay for this? Normalizing relations with Iran. A lot of people in the U.S. don't want it, those lobbies I was talking about. The problem is, if the U.S. does not normalize relations with Iran, Iran has already normalized these relations with the people that matter, the Russians and the Chinese. Mm-hmm. I was writing about this week as well. There is already a strategic partnership between Russia, Iran, and China that is translating into a military partnership as well. The sale of the S-300 missile systems to Iran, the sale of the S-400 systems to China, Russia perfecting the S-500 systems for itself. Soon, in the next few years, everybody's going to have the S-500, which means their airspace will be sealed to anything the U.S., the Pentagon, throws at them. And the Pentagon knows, and they are terrified about it. Some of my American sources have been keeping me abreast all the time about it. So that's it. It's Eurasia integration with Russia, China, and Iran, and the Americans on the other side completely isolated. What? Their main interlocutor is austerity-ravaged Europe, where I am at the moment, where nobody here has a vision for the future. And everybody here is basically fearful of the future because they know that Europe is being completely marginalized by the U.S. on one side and by Russia and China on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So this is if the Obama administration, if they had a little bit of vision for the future, they would go for this deal, a decent deal for both sides. That's what they should have been doing for months now. And in fact, they keep tergiversations, lateral maneuvers. They are not really sure that they want this deal. And when you look at the intellectual caliber of the people around Obama, you understand why. Because these people are essentially mediocre and they don't have a big picture view of the benefits for the U.S. to have a normal relationship with Iran.
Indeed. And they still are so intimidated by Netanyahu and Israel.
Yes.
That even though, Obama, after the Netanyahu missteps around his election, the embarrassing speech before Congress, and then the racist comment, and the there will be no two-state solution as long as I'm prime minister, Obama seized that moment, and the way I describe it, he dialed back his support. It used to be at 900%, now it's at 850%. But the demand from the Israeli lobby is that it must be at 1,000% at all times.
Yes.
And so, he's pivoted a little bit to try to pinch Netanyahu, but I don't think it has much impact. And certainly when you've got a senator like Tom Cotton, who in a very tight election got $2 million in late money from Bill Kristol's Emergency Committee for Israel and two other mega donors, you see the clear linkage between the domestic politics and the intrusion in foreign policy. And let me contrast that, because once again, we have news from Afghanistan, which I call the whatever war, because no matter what Obama does, Americans just say whatever. And so we have an inspector general report that they can't account for the latest missing money. It's only $1.3 billion this week. And the New York Times very politely reported that the Obama administration appears to be expanding beyond the mission that has been defined. Now, they're using euphemistic bullshit. What we have here is that Obama is running the equivalent of Nixon's secret wars in Laos and Cambodia, but it's not really a secret. It's all out in the open. We just have an American public that is so passive and has moved on from Afghanistan. And so, once again, they say, whatever. And this is a very significant issue to me, because Obama has given five or six different scenarios for the end game in Afghanistan, and then he just arbitrarily changes those plans, and there is no political price that he pays whatsoever. There is no pushback from any Democrat, because it's being done by Obama, and the Republicans just say, well, yeah, this is what we always wanted, so we'll hammer him over other things, but we'll go silent on the continuing U.S. military activity in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. And you know who's going to solve the Afghan problem? The Chinese. Did you know that the Taliban and the Chinese are talking off the record?
No.
Behind ultra-closed doors.
And why haven't we sent a drone to bust
exactly,
that up?
Exactly. And the Chinese are, in fact, they are trying to, with the Russians as well, as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of course, they are trying to, okay, let's come up with an alternative scenario. Pakistan is already in China's pocket. Just look at the deals that they clinched a few days ago. So Pakistan will stop supporting the Taliban. It has already stopped supporting the Taliban on the Afghan side, and obviously they have to deal with the Pakistani Taliban, which try to subvert Islamabad. So it's for their best interest to reach an accommodation with the Afghan Taliban, the original Afghan Taliban. So if the Afghan Taliban get something from the Chinese in terms of, I don't know, could be royalties, could be participation in a government, could be transit rights for a pipeline, you name it, then they solve the Afghan problem within an Asian framework, which is the Chinese foreign ministry has been saying. We are involved in finding a peaceful solution for Afghanistan by Asians. Hmm. So you get the picture. And obviously the Taliban, they are very, very clever. If they get their cut, that's it. It's fine. The problem is what to do with the Obama remnants, which include tens of thousands of defense contractors still in Bagram Air Base, in three other air bases in Afghanistan. What's going to happen to these people? Because a partial occupation of Afghanistan is still in effect. When you have more than 10,000 troops plus defense contractors, you're actually occupying a great deal of Afghanistan. Well, and obviously, no one in the U.S. is paying attention to that.
And Pepe, in this New York Times story, again, let me just read you this sanitized statement. Now, though, the distance seems to be widening between the administration's public statements and what the military appears to be doing, whether at behest of the White House or on its own. It goes on to say that General Campbell, who is running the show there in Afghanistan now, is essentially the acting defense minister of the Ghani government. Ghani, who is yet to name a defense minister, has in many ways outsourced much of the running of the war to General Campbell. And then they have specific examples of how events that were described as force protection occurred in areas where we have no forces to protect, where the argument of force protection was used in obvious aggression by American forces. And yet, again, the reaction on these shores is, whatever. It's Afghanistan.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Exactly. But that's a very good description that Campbell is the defense minister of Ghani. It's absolutely correct, in fact. And, the Taliban know it. The Taliban, in fact, the spring offensive started last Friday, a week ago. So you won't read about the spring offensive in the American media, I'm sure. And there are not even American reporters anymore in Afghanistan covering the Taliban offensive. They hold on to the territory that they have, which is, wow, I would say at least 60% of Afghanistan is in Taliban's hands. Helmand, much of the west, parts of the northwest as well. Apart from the Panjshir Valley, some of the northeast. So, And retreat. In fact, there's no retreat. NATO lost the war in Afghanistan. Whatever you want to sell it to Europe and to the U.S., that's it. They lost the war, and now they don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. They're going to fight a Taliban offensive with 10,000 American soldiers? I don't think so. They had 100,000, and still they couldn't do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Pepe, one of the threads of your reporting for the last few years that is quite prominent in your new book, Empire of Chaos, is what you have dubbed the New Silk Road, the Chinese Silk Road 2.0. And in a couple of your recent posts at Asia Times, you detailed some of the latest developments. And I wanted to tie those together with some unusual reporting that occurred this past week on the 60 Minutes show on CBS here stateside. And it was an obvious packaged leak from the Pentagon to CBS News. And just as an aside, it could be their reward for going soft on all the whistleblower cases that they have softballed in the past. At any rate, this was a clear propaganda piece that was delivered as a package by the U.S. Space Command. And they described how we're, building up our infrastructure. We're monitoring inner and outer space on a regular basis. And the claim is that we don't want to militarize a space, but we're going to make sure that nobody else does either. That's what we're told. But the key gets in this 60 Minutes package were to transmit to the American people that the Chinese have really developed some remarkable capabilities. And a couple of years ago, they managed to shoot down one of their own satellites in a remarkable demonstration of their growing capabilities. Now, one of the problems is the space debris from the shoot down of that satellite has created problems for everybody else who has assets up there. The other big finding from the 60 Minutes report is that in 2013, China successfully launched a missile into deep space, which is where we have a lot of our geo-positioned orbiting satellites and assets. And this was seen as a very grave threat to the U.S. military dominance of outer space. So there are a lot of mixed messages in that package, but the fundamental message was that we need to be afraid of China. And when you tie that together with their activities on Earth, the recent disclosure that they're building an airstrip on those reefs that are in the contested area of the South China Sea, the propaganda message to the American people is now not only that we need to worry about the grave threats presented by Daesh, but that the evil Chinese communist government is one that we have to fear both on Earth and in space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, there are two major threats, of course. The only two possible competitors, or they're, even if they're not competitors, but the only two nations who can dash America's hope of 21st century as an American century and, you know, unbridled hegemony as before are Russia and China. So, you know, for the moment, the demonization of Russia, people have had enough of it, and it's not going very well because Russia, in fact, it didn't work. Yeah. And last week, Putin was saying almost with a smile on his face. In fact, I detected a smirk on his face when he said, look, we weathered the very, very heavy economic storm. Russia is recovering. The ruble is recovering. And it is. I was in Russia, 4 weeks ago, and I saw the ruble going up every day. The middle classes in Russia are, you know, back to shopping as usual. The economy is slowly rebounding. They weather the oil price war to the point of one of my American sources in the energy industry is telling me that the Saudis are thinking of going to Moscow to talk to the Russians about it, which means that what the Saudis planned and the Americans endorsed didn't work as well. So now we go back once again to the other major threat, China. So while we have the Chinese doing deals with everybody and his neighbor in terms of the new Silk Roads, which once again will go, it's a three-pronged Silk Road. One is through Russia, the Trans-Siberian on high-speed rail goes all the way to Europe. The other one is through the Central Asian stands going through Iran and Turkey. Very important, and then to Italy and to Germany. And the other one is the Maritime Silk Road going through the Indian Ocean all the way to Venice in the Mediterranean.
Well, so, and not to be too expansive, but there is also this proposed new canal through Nicaragua to connect the Atlantic and the Pacific, funded by a Chinese billionaire, but that's presumably a government-backed operation, right?
Government backed up completely with the Chinese companies who will be in charge of building the actual canal. Just like when the Chinese won a pipeline from Central Asia, Chinese companies build a pipeline. This is what happened with Turkmenistan, for instance. Or in Brazil, in Argentina, where the Chinese keep clinching deals every week, apart from the deal that Russia clinched with Argentina a few days ago as well. So this is all to say that China, that Russia is not isolated as the White House likes to spin it, or the State Department. And China and Russia together, there are going to be two very important summits this summer in Russia. One is the BRICS summit. The other one is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. all these things that we are talking now, they will be detailed during the summits in terms of the expansion of the new Silk Roads, which companies are going to build the Trans-Siberia on the high-speed rail Trans-Siberian, which companies will be acting in Central Asia, how Russian and Chinese companies can collaborate in the merging of the new Silk Road with the Eurasian Economic Union. One is a Russia-led mechanism. Another one is a Chinese-led mechanism. So while they are discussing trade, commerce, deals, integration of Eurasia, you know, the recent Chinese-Pakistani deals as well, the Pentagon is talking about what? War. Cyber war, missile deployment capability. It's completely crazy. It's over and over again. It's the same thing. In fact, I should be writing the same article every week, just updating one paragraph, because it's the same story. And in fact, when I start looking at my articles, I say, oh my God, I'm writing the same piece over and over again, because it is the same story. On one side, we have the infinite expansion of the long war in its terrorism declinations and its against Russia and China declinations. And on the other side, we have the Russians and the Chinese doing deals among themselves with other Asian partners and looking towards an integration from Lisbon to Vladivostok, as Putin said, or from Shanghai to Berlin, as the Chinese are saying. It's very easy to compare both strategies, isn't it? It's so glaringly obvious, especially for the developing world. And that's why nobody in the developing world, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Europe, the West, and the Atlanticist gang. I'm talking about South America, Africa, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, East Asia. All these countries, they're paying attention at, okay, Eurasian integration, trade, and commerce. We're in. Why do you think 57 countries, the last time I counted, joined the Asian, the AIBB bank founded by the Chinese? Mm-hmm. Why? Because they don't trust the World Bank anymore. And this is something that I have been hearing from Global South diplomats for 20 years now, all the time. Finally, there is an alternative. The same thing, instead of war on terror, which is what we have been sold by the U.S. for the past almost 15 years, we have the Russians and Chinese selling now economic integration. So that's it. The whole story for me is there. In the next few years, it's going to be, Peter, I'm sorry, the same story over and over again every week with, you know, a few addenda. But it's the same thing. On one side, we have to counter threats. One day is Daesh, the next day is Iran, the next day is China, the next day is Russia, the next day is all of them together. And on the other side, commercial deals, integration, building high-speed rails, fiber optic cables, you know, doing more organization and coordination of Asian-based mechanisms in trade, in commerce, political, economic, security, etc.
And arguably, there will be more distribution of wealth from those investments, yes, that you described by Russia and, yeah, China, than the war profiteering on the U.S. side that, yeah, that not only, you know, continues to fuel the deficits that requires the United States to borrow from China, but also just, you know, widens the gap between the haves and have-nots in this country in a way that hollows out the middle class and reduces the value of the United States as a market. And so with that, and I'm going to let you go to that brasserie for dinner here because I promised Pepe, but I want to get your thoughts about the pathetic negotiations over the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. Abe from Japan was at the White House this week, and we're told there was no breakthrough. Well, I consider that to be good news, because
it is good
news. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is dressed up as a global pivot, when in fact it is a thinly disguised effort to get Japan to allow us to sell cars and some produce, meats and vegetables in their markets, which we can't currently do. And the trade-off is huge losses laws to labor, environmental, and intellectual property protections in a shift that gives corporations incredible power. And, of course, Obama doesn't even concede that all of this has been negotiated in secret. And the deal that he says is such a great deal, if you just look at it, is something that we're not allowed to look at. It's all just preposterous.
It is. I agree with you. And it's in fact, there are two deals now. There's the TPP for Asia and the transatlantic deal here in Europe. A few months ago, I was, in fact, I still keep doing this. Whenever I go to the countryside in Europe, in France, in Italy, on Spain, I talk to local producers. And one of my first questions is about the transatlantic partnership deal. And they all say, no way. We're going to start a war here because this is Monsanto and Cargill and etc. coming here and taking over our agriculture, which is what's going to happen. And the Japanese in Asia are saying the same thing. This is big American companies coming here and taking care of our agriculture. And if you talk to executives in the auto industry, taking care of, you know, decimating our auto industry as well. So Japan won't agree to the TPP the way it's being sold by the Obama administration at the moment. And you're right. It was negotiated in secret by a bunch of corporate heads. There's no transparency. There's no discussion inside America and all over Asia as well. Just like the transatlantic partnership is not discussed here in Europe. You never see a word about it. I mean, in terms of discussing contact in mainstream media in France, in Britain, or in Italy, or in Germany. This is discussed only in online forums, you know, informally, etc. But if you go to the countryside anywhere in Europe, there is a mounting revolt that, no, Brussels will never accept it. And the problem is Brussels works like Washington. All these big multinationals, they have very well paid and very organized lobbies in Brussels. Mm. So that's why, like many, like, you know, the Merkel government, for instance, is in favor of this this deal, unlike a lot of German agricultural producers, for instance. I'm not sure Merkel is going to pick a fight with their own people to have this deal passed to the benefit of corporations that are not even German.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan, the same thing. Malaysia as well. Apart from Japan, Malaysia is a vociferous opponent of the TPP. I would say the TPP, for the moment, they have smaller countries who think that they will have a better deal. Chile, for instance. Chile is a neoliberal paradise, in fact. New Zealand. But that's it, the smaller countries. The big important Asian countries, they are against it.
And the
definition is NATO on trade, Peter.
Yeah.
For both, both deals are NATO on trade. That's it. And, you know, and officials and diplomats, they are already started circulating this.
Well, and the other piece of it is it appears the Obama administration has jumped the gun here by trying to get fast-track approval before there is even a deal in place, and we already addressed the lack of transparency. So how they're planning to, you know, ram this through the pipeline without amendments when it's going to be a big surprise to a lot of the senators and members of Congress when they actually see what's in it. And that's going to produce a lot of pushback from various constituencies. And when you describe the opposition of Malaysia, and we see, obviously, the continuing resistance of Japan, it seems to me like they're wasting a lot of political capital on a deal that barely exists.
Political capital they don't even have, right?
Yeah, well, we can borrow it from China.
Borrowed from China. And obviously, and all the Asian partners know that this deal is a way to bypass China. And something that you never see in American corporate media. China is the number one trading partner of virtually all these countries. So who are you going to deal business with? The faraway U.S. and American multinationals, or preferentially with your number one trading partner, which is already there. And you want to get a piece of the Chinese market as well. So, you know, that's it.
Well, Pepe, once again, the empire is in chaos, and there is no real no change in sight.
No, there's no change in sight. Well, maybe retiring to Oregon.
That sounds pretty tempting. Well, Pepe, yeah. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today. And
Thanks very much, Peter.
Helping always share your unique perspective with my listeners.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. And let's keep talking.
Around the World with Pepe Escobar in an hour. Your comments are always welcome. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.